This is dedicated to the children, to all the children, to the children who swim beneath the waves of the sea, to those who live in the soil of the earth, to the children of the flowers and the meadows and the trees in the forest, to all those children who roam over the land and the winged ones who fly with the wind. To the human children, too, but to all the children, they go together into the future, in the full diversity of their regional communities.
In Canada, for years, we've been bludgeoned by the mantra over and over again that the economy is the most important thing in our society. We've been told that we have to sacrifice for the sake of the economy, that we have to give up social services in our communities for the sake of the economy. So the economy in my society is seen as the source of everything that matters. I actually had a minister of the environment who said to me, "Listen, Suzuki, if we don't have a strong growing economy, we can't afford to protect the environment." And it's, as a biologist, this has never made any sense to me, to say that the economy is the bottom line when there's a much greater reality, and that is that we as biological creatures live within the confines of the biosphere, the zone of air, water, and land where life exists. And it's the biosphere that gives us everything. You take this room, from the air you can't see to the glass, the metal, the plastic, the energy, everything has come from the earth. And when we're finished with it, we'll throw it back into the earth. So it's the biosphere that is really the source of everything that matters to us, including the economy.
And there is a fundamental law in the governance of Earth, in all of the expressions of life, that no one organism can overwhelm the community and survive. Each organism must come up against the constraints imposed on it as community. Earth is community. No one species in the whole process has evolved apart from the relationships by which it's bound in the local community in which it finds itself.
One of the most humiliating statistics to me as a Canadian is that in the last 40 years, the average size of a Canadian family has decreased by 50%. And yet in the same period, the average size of a Canadian house has doubled. Why is it the average person in a house now then needs four times as much space than we did 40 years ago? Because we've got so much junk to put in it.
Gonna fly that high. There's no escaping, the enemy is you and I. We poison up the water, we're choking on the air. Let's stop before it gets too late. Or is it already too late? Is it already too late for the victims of comfort? Got no one else to blame. We're just the victims of comfort, connoisseurs of pain. It's a technological merry-go-round, dangerous solutions buried under the ground.
We are slaves in the sense that we depend for our daily survival upon an expand or expire agro-industrial empire, a crackpot that the specialists cannot comprehend and the managers cannot manage. which is, furthermore, devouring world resources at an exponential rate. We are, most of us, dependent employees. A statement that is daily verified by the Daily News.
Oh, and what do we got to lose? Everything. Yes, and what do we stand to gain?
It's true that white men came to this country looking for spices. And it's also true that there would not be a United States if there wasn't a trade dispute over dumping. And it was the same British East India Company that was dumping tea at a very low price onto the American market, and it really angered the tea distributors on the East Coast. And that was really the beginning of the United States. So globalization, and particularly the global trade in agricultural goods, is as old as mankind. But the question is, what are the terms of that trade? And who is benefiting from it? Now, when there was a British Empire, the British Empire benefited profoundly from it. And when they followed a mercantilist policy, they used their colonies as sources of raw material that they would exploit. But once it was in their interest, and once they had a very strong manufacturing base, they turned to, quote, free trade, unquote, because it was in their interest. Again and again, you see the terms of world trade being dictated by the dominant world power. The only free trade there is right now, I would argue, is that you are free to give large sums of money to the Republican Party, and in return, you will be able to trade. So when you're talking about this global trade in agriculture, or you're talking about the world economic system and how it's been transformed in the last 20 years, what you're talking about is a centralization of corporate power and a growth in corporate power. And I don't come to this in a narrowly anti-corporate way, but I am opposed to the unbridled corporate power that we now see in the world. And it is of enormous importance when it comes to food. It may just be irritating when it comes to music, but when it comes to food, it has profound importance because there is no other industry without food. Food is the bedrock of our civilization, and as Wendell has written about for years, it is the determinant of the physical landscape and the cultural landscape. And I think that we have to look at the product that is being pushed onto the world as a form of pollution. It is a form of pollution that is polluting not just the landscape through these gigantic factory farms, through genetically modified organisms that we have no idea what the consequences are going to be for generations. But it's also a pollution of our culture and of our society, this centralized, uniform corporate culture that I would argue is the antithesis of freedom. It's the antithesis of anything that Adam Smith ever envisaged. And it's much closer to corporate socialism. And when you look at where those subsidies are going, and not just the farm subsidies going to agribusiness, but the enormous subsidies that are given to the oil companies, we will fight wars for them, we will send our young to die for them. This is a cost too high to pay. So I would argue that this cheap food is much, much too expensive for our culture. Now, I wrote about McDonald's. McDonald's, a few years ago, had a slogan that I found telling and chilling, and their slogan was, "One Taste Worldwide." Now, all you need to do is draw a little mustache on Ronald, and you get a sense of what that ideology ultimately means. And we have dealt for the last 100 years with one ideology after another that's trying to impose uniformity and conformity. And what everyone on this panel is arguing for is the antithesis, which is a respect for diversity, a respect for regional identity.
all food chains, even the most globalized and complex, begin with plants growing in a specific patch of soil somewhere. So I'm going to use my time to look at the global food chain from one of its earthly starting points, which is a cornfield in Iowa. The globalization of food we're hearing about is largely a supply-driven phenomenon, and much of that drive originates in the American Corn Belt. So I want to, at kind of warp speed, follow a bushel of Iowa corn through the food chain, specifically corn from a farmer named George Naylor in Chardin, Iowa. He's just harvested, and he harvested 200 bushels of corn an acre. That is an astonishing amount of food. We hear this word bushel, and we kind of think we know what it means, but it's 56 pounds of corn. So 200 bushels in an acre is 10,000 pounds of food. One American farmer can feed 118 people now. A lot of our food system is about figuring out ways to get rid of those 200 bushels of corn an acre. So 60% of it, on average, we feed to livestock. It goes to factory farms. 10% we eat ourselves in the form of high fructose corn syrup and other goodies that are made from corn. 10% we feed to our cars now, and it will soon be more in the form of ethanol. And 20% we export, and that's really what we're going to talk about. According to the grain elevator that buys George Naylor's corn every fall, much of that 20% finds its way to Mexico. Since NAFTA, and the reason I want to talk about Mexico is that it's kind of ahead of the curve on globalization. They have already opened their borders. They have already kind of globalized their economy under NAFTA. The U.S. has doubled its exports of corn to Mexico. This is, of course, the country that gave us corn in the first place, where corn evolved. Now we're selling it back to them with all sorts of serious consequences, environmental, social, economic. So why does Mexico, the ancestral home of corn, buy 200 million bushels of American corn today? Well, in a word, because it's cheap. Because farmers like Naylor can sell it for less than $2 a bushel. And this is almost a dollar less than it costs to produce that bushel of corn. So how can that be? How do they sell corn for a dollar less than it costs to make it? Well, that's a complicated story. And subsidies are the culprit you always hear about. And the government is cutting a check to George Naylor for every bushel of corn he produces. And that makes up a lot of that distance between the sale price and the cost of production. But I would argue that that mountain of cheap corn that's washing over the world right now preceded subsidies and will survive their elimination if that ever happens. But I'll get back to that right at the end. The key factor in all this, the supply-driven kind of wash of corn across the world, is not subsidies so much as overproduction, simply the astounding productivity of an Iowa cornfield. This is, you know, there's 6 feet of topsoil in these places. There used to be about 12, it's true, but there still is 6 feet of topsoil. Much of the yield growth that's driven all this corn, created this mountain, has been pushed by government and industry. And it's usually been done under the banner, the blameless sounding banner of feeding the world. Every innovation, that argument has been cited. Yet it turns out that in the real world, too much food is almost as big a problem as too little. The same mountain of cheap grain is contributing to the obesity crisis in this country, because all that corn is really the building block of Eric's fast food nation. It creates the cheap beef. It makes possible the big sodas, the big gulps. And it contributes in other places to hunger, which sound from Africa to Mexico. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive. How could this be? Cheap food making people hungry. But that actually is exactly what's happening. And I just want to try to give you an idea how that could be in my time, remaining time. So let's follow that corn to Mexico. Since NAFTA, as I said, we're exporting twice as much corn, 200 million bushels. What's been the impact? Well, the Carnegie Endowment just last week issued a very interesting report on this. These are not radicals. I could cite Food First, who was there first, but I'll cite the Carnegie Endowment. Since NAFTA, about 10 years ago, the price of corn in Mexico dropped 50%. This collapse in the price of corn the result of all we're exporting, has forced 1.3 million farmers off their land. They can't compete against the flood tide of American corn. So where do they go? Well, they join the pools of the unemployed in Mexico's cities, and many of them migrate to the United States, where these former farmers end up picking our food to send money back home. That, too, is part of the globalization of food. Not all Mexican farmers lose. Bigger farmers growing for export are selling fresh fruits and vegetables in the United States, which is a good and a bad thing. We now can get vegetables any season. It's true some of them come with hepatitis, but that, too, is part of globalization. A lot of these export farms end up buying the land from these small farmers, consolidating it, and we end up with a situation under free trade where it makes economic sense for a hungry country to use its best land to feed a country where food is so abundant that people are obese. This makes economic sense. It obviously doesn't make human sense. It doesn't make environmental sense. Those export farms intensify their agriculture to compete. And all this cheap corn is leading to the industrialization of their livestock. This is a people who never used to feed corn to animals. They thought it was sacrilegious, and now they have factory farms and all the pollution problems that come with it. And then lastly, there is the problem of genetic pollution. Our genetically engineered corn traits, as a researcher on this campus has found, has now shown up in the ancestral land races of corn. Very important genetic heritage that has now been contaminated. But in fact, the bigger threat to that genetic diversity, and we depend on that to keep this crop healthy, is the loss of these small farmers. Because corn is as dependent on us as we are on it. Without farmers to farm it every year, it goes extinct. And if our cheap corn drives those farmers out of business as it is, there will not be the genes that we need to keep this crop alive and all the people who depend on it. Thank you very much.
And over the years I've been working on these technology issues, I think behind a lot of this, they'll talk to you about utility, and we'll talk a little about that later. But I think there's something I call the technological imagination, and I think we have to face it front up, which is I think there is a romance about breaking limits. You know, there's an AT&T commercial that says, imagine a world without limits, where everything is possible. And I think for much of the last century, we've engaged, not always consciously, in the creating of this imaginary world where there are no limits, where everything is possible. And so when we see a car breaking the sound barrier, or we see a gigantic mouse with human genes, or we see somebody walking on the moon, which also turned out to have very little utility. But the point was, we'd broken a barrier. We had confirmed the propaganda of the technological imagination that that's what we're about as a community. That's what we're about as the human community, to create a world without limits, where anything is possible. And I think if there's one lesson that we should get when we look at genetic engineering, the breaking of species boundaries the way they are, is that we need a new romance of limits. We need to understand what makes anything lovable, anything understandable is limits. You can't even play a game without limits. You can't have good relationships without limits. And we certainly can't have a good relationship with the natural world without a deep understanding of limits. But this is a very graphic demonstration of the technological imagination work. This is not really so much an act of science as one of imagination, in my view.
We don't know the long-term effects of these transgenic manipulations. We don't know what it's going to do to the organisms within which we carry out the manipulations. We certainly don't know what's going to happen when we introduce such organisms into the food stream. And we don't know what's going to happen when we start making drugs which are being used by these manipulations, or we begin to use them for other purposes. It's too early. You know, we've learned through painful experience in the United States and other places that you don't include people in an experiment without getting informed consent. You tell them what the experiment's about, you tell them what you're going to do to them, and then you ask them to say, okay. You know what Europeans, who take food much more seriously than we do in North America, you know what they say about GMOs? If you want to find out whether they're dangerous or not, just watch the Canadians. They're doing the experiment for us. We have been involved in a massive experiment for over 5 years now. GMOs are in the food stream, and we've never given our consent.
My starting point is the failure of the environmental movement to envision and promote a conserving land-based economy. The movement has failed to foresee or envision a mean between the pristine and the utterly spoiled. There's talk now among biologists of dividing the world 50-50 between nature preserves and industrial farming and forestry. But this abandons any hope of harmony between human life and the life of the world, without which neither can be preserved. We have failed to address the issue of local adaptation, which is a law from which no species is exempt, including our own. And we are now farther from obedience to that law than we've ever been before. The present land economy of farming, forestry, and so on rests on a foundation of general ignorance. Most of us don't know how we live or at what cost, either ecologically or humanly. We speak sentimentally of a sense of place and of having roots. But a sense of place, if it is of any real worth, consists of a set of correct practical solutions to local problems. Why are locally adapted economies necessary? We have talked enough, maybe, about the pleasures of fresh, tasty, locally produced food. We have not talked nearly enough about the vulnerability of economic systems that are both global and centralized. Their vulnerability, that is, to epidemics, terrorism, and other forms of human and natural violence. Nor have we acknowledged clearly enough that these very extensive systems are entirely dependent on cheap transportation, which is entirely dependent on cheap petroleum. It now seems that petroleum, for which there is no substitute, is going to become more expensive in money and perhaps in blood. And so we have got to begin again to think about limits, ecological and moral. For how long can we maintain the industrialist superstition that we can feed the world by destroying the world's capacity to produce food? And are we, in the developed nations, really prepared to feed ourselves by buying food off the plates of people in poorer countries? What are we Americans to think of ourselves, who find it easy to condemn the Negro slavery of the Old South, and equally easy to live off the labor of racially denominated wage slaves in fields and factories here and elsewhere? The world is limited in land, water, fertility, and energy. In such a world, people with moral limits must develop their local economies, must shorten their supply lines, and take responsibility for their economic influence. Unless we believe the cheap long-distance transportation is somehow infinite, we cannot justify the destruction of any local capacity to produce necessary goods. A due regard to local economy does not preclude a regional, national, or global economy. Nor does the existence of the larger economies necessarily interfere with the proper development of local economies, so long as the principles of subsistence and surplus are respected throughout. Only the surplus should be exploited after local needs have been met. The surplus can then be passed along as charity or as commodities fairly priced. The principles of subsistence, charity, and fair pricing belong to an economy of neighborliness and are directly opposed to the principles of the industrial economy and the so-called free market.
Say, can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war? Where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with on earth.
Perhaps a new revelatory experience is taking place. An experience wherein human consciousness awakens to the grandeur and sacred quality of the earth process. Humanity has seldom participated in such a vision since shamanic times. But in such a renewal lies our hope for the future for ourselves and for the entire planet on which we live.